Topic number two. 2 days ago, there was a new flood of bad economic news out of Washington. Official unemployment figures jumped from 7.5% to 8% in October, just 1 month's time. The deep slumps in housing and autos are getting deeper, and the Reagan promise of a balanced federal budget by 1984 has now been officially abandoned. At the same time, government figures show that more and more people are going deeper and deeper into debt. Even as the economy slows down, galloping inflation is continuing to make it harder to make ends meet. Meanwhile, the privately owned Federal Reserve Corporation is maintaining the high interest rates that are strangling the economy. It has been only a few short weeks since America's recession was first admitted at all by the President. The entity President Reagan startled reporters by saying the country is in a mild recession. Then other government spokesmen softened the blow, calling it a flat period, quote unquote. Now, these casual-sounding early admissions are being replaced by reports that grow worse by the day. America's economy is turning sour too fast for reassuring smiles and empty phrases to hide it any longer. If you want to understand what is really happening to the United States economy, you must keep your eyes on the basics. There are two critical sectors of the economy which are the keys to bringing about prosperity or depression. Those sectors are automobiles and housing. Both are in deep trouble now, and as they go down, they are pulling down our whole economy with them. The techniques which were used to bring on the Great Depression of the 1930s are once again being used now. 6 years ago, in Audio Letter 5, I talked briefly about the wise German professor who taught me finance, banking, and economics. In the 1920s, this man had been consulted by the Rockefeller interests, who claimed that they wanted to know how to deflate inflation. But once he had shown them how it could be done, they misused his information to create the Great Depression instead. This German economist confided many things to me, and one was how economies are manipulated. He showed me how the key sectors of housing and the automobiles can be used to bring down a whole economy. And 3 years ago, in Audio Letter 41, I gave an early warning that this process was being set in motion. As I reported then, General Motors betrayed its advanced knowledge of the plan for a new American depression on November 7, 1978. On that day, GM slashed its dividend rates in half on GM stock. GM's action 3 years ago took the stock market by surprise because auto sales had been good. But since that time, interest rates have climbed into the loan shark range, and both automobiles and housing have hit upon hard times. A few days ago, it was announced that auto sales in the United States have slumped to their lowest level in 23 years. The last time things were this bad, we were in the severe recession of 1957 to 1958. But, my friends, you haven't seen anything yet. Housing is no better off. Incredible interest rates, combined with unchecked inflation and basic prices, have cut housing sales of all kinds to a trickle. When you hear those monthly statistics about deepening unemployment, my friends, keep in mind that they are only a symptom of what is happening. General unemployment is following down the same path that is being taken in housing and autos. In many metropolitan areas, unemployment in construction trades has already reached 20% and is still increasing. Likewise, layoffs are steadily increasing the unemployment rate in autos. Lost jobs in those two sectors mean other businesses will slow down too. And so general unemployment can do nothing but get worse as things stand right now. Millions of American working people are growing nervous as they see what is happening. Many are especially worried because they sense a fundamental shift taking place in the government's attitude toward labor. Several weeks ago, these worries were expressed in the so-called Solidarity Day rally of 250,000 people right here in Washington. This time, the rally was peaceful, but I must report that forces are now at work that are threatening to erupt in violent riots. both here in Washington and in other major cities soon. One catalyst for these riots is likely to be the abrupt cancellation of benefits for the needy. The problem is not so much what is being done as the way it is being done. Instead of phasing out these programs in a way that would give a period of adjustment, they are just being lopped off. Many people are being made to feel that they are being cast onto the trash heap. Resentment and desperation are building. At the same time, shortages are coming in America. These shortages will come to include food sooner than most of us imagine. One of the favorite political weapons of the Bolsheviks has always been hunger, because it is so powerful. They used it long ago in Russia. They are using it today in Poland, and they will use it tomorrow right here in the United States. Widespread hunger can be brought about in America even if there is no lack of agricultural production. In that respect, the situation has changed dramatically during the past year, because, my friends, the Soviet Union has called off its program of weather modification to reduce our crops. If you will recall, the Bolshevik-dominated former Carter administration declared a grain embargo against Russia in January 1980. The following month, I reported in Audio Letter 54 that the Kremlin was retaliating by means of massive modification of America's weather. For the next 4 months, I was not able to give monthly updates on the situation because I was recovering from a near-fatal heart attack. But by the time I resumed my audio letter series in June 1980, the weather had become big news here in America. Vast growing areas of the United States were in the grip of a scorching drought that was both unexpected and very severe. The Russians made sure that they got their point across to our peanut farmer president then in office. For the first time on record, the Deep South peanut crop failed in 1980. It was destroyed by the weather. The United States grain embargo against Russia had been a Bolshevik attempt to use the hunger weapon on an international scale, but it backfired. The Russians tightened their belts a notch, but suffered little. Instead, it was the United States that was on the brink of an era of hunger due to crop failure, and it would have taken place in ways that could have caused real trouble for our own unseen rulers. They want to impose hunger on you and me, but only on their own timetable, as a way to control us. And so 6 months ago, the grain embargo against Russia was ended. As a result, America's weather returned to normal during the summer of 1981, just past. The drought-stricken areas of a year ago have in many cases received drenching rains to restore their productivity. As I said earlier, the immediate threat of hunger in America is no longer due to crop failure caused by Russian weather modification. Instead, when hunger strikes, it may well be brought about by a sudden disruption of our food distribution system. Today, we live in an age of agribusiness, with production of most of our foodstuffs concentrated in a few prime areas. The greatest concentration of all is in California, which produces from 40 to 50% of many of our fruits and vegetables. Other agricultural states specialize in other parts of our food supply, grains, meats, and so forth. What ties the whole country together so that we all have food to eat is transportation. There is a motto that says, America's needs move by truck. Nowhere is that more true than it is for our food supply. Supermarkets nationwide carry only about a 3-day supply of food on their shelves. They have to be restocked continuously by a steady stream of trucks. Trucks, my friends, depend upon petroleum supplies in order to keep moving. Once the Saudi oil fields are capped off by the Israeli nuclear strike, there will be a sudden cutoff of much of our oil. If the plan is carried out successfully, it will mean gas rationing and restricted movement for us all. It will also mean serious disruptions in food distribution. A while ago, I mentioned the recent Washington rally under the name Solidarity Day. In a way, that was an ironic name to choose. It makes one think of the so-called Solidarity Labor Union in Poland. In Poland, the Solidarity Union is a tool of the American Bolsheviks, who are trying to destroy the economy for purposes of revolution and war. Here in America, the American Bolsheviks are also trying to destroy the economy, and for similar reasons. But here, they are trying to do it through the government itself. As America's economy continues to deteriorate, the battle continues in the secret power struggle to control the United States government. The two factions in this power struggle are the state Bolsheviks and the corporate fascists, as I detailed in Audio Letter 67. Lately, this struggle is surfacing in public skirmishes. The latest example is the flap over the White House guerrilla campaign, quote-unquote, against Secretary of State Alexander Haig. Meanwhile, the destruction of our economy is continuing. Our country is being Polandized. That is, America is being weakened economically to set the stage for war, just as is being done to Poland. America's economic destruction is being orchestrated by the money managers of the Federal Reserve Corporation and Treasury Department. But to maintain the pretense of trying to help our economy, the plan for a bogus new gold standard for our currency or treasury bonds is still moving ahead quietly. I can report that the Federal Gold Commission has now had its life quietly extended by Congress until March 31, 1982. The gold standard ploy is intended to look good, but it is a sham. How can an alleged gold standard mean anything if the alleged gold reserves do not exist? After all, when President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, it was because America's gold reserves had been secretly depleted. Nixon's Treasury Secretary at the time was John Connally, and he has now gone public with strong opposition to the gold standard idea. And his reason is simple. Last month, the New York Times for October 19 quoted Connally as saying, "We don't have the gold," unquote. Wherever you look, there are nothing but questions about the true status of America's gold supplies. For example, 3 years ago, the major media for once created a sensation about the New York Assay Office. They reported, correctly, that some 5,000 ounces of gold were missing, gone without a trace. Well, my friends, the major media ought to go back and check again with their sources. For the fiscal year ended September 30, 1981, there is still more gold missing at the New York Assay Office. Supposedly, there was a tightening of security and procedures there after the scandal 3 years ago. At least, that's what the Treasury Department told the public. But for this past year alone, another 3,163 ounces of gold have vanished. Yes, my friends, America is being Polandized. Just as Poland is the victim of deliberate economic turmoil, so are we. The objective in Poland is to bring on social upheaval, bloodshed, and the prelude to war. And that is also the objective right here in the United States. When unemployment and hunger riots materialize, they will trigger the secret military Operation Garden Plot, which I first reported in the summer of 1975. It is all part of the plan for a national emergency to come on the way to nuclear war one. Topic number 3. Early last month, on October 2, the entity President Reagan announced his long-awaited decision on the MX missile program. For the past several years, we've been hearing about the MX and all kinds of possible mobile basing for it. We've been told that the MX will have to be mobile in order to survive a Russian nuclear attack. Having heard this for years, a lot of people were shocked when they heard the Reagan decision on the MX. He declared that the famous MX racetrack system out west will not be built after all. Instead, they will simply be used to replace aging Titan missiles when deployment begins in 1986. At least that is the announced plan for the first 36 MX missiles. The President said, in effect, that he doesn't yet know what to do with the rest of the MXs that will be built. That is so even though the Reagan administration plans to build only 100 of them, half as many as previously planned. Many people who closely follow defense matters were stunned by the announcement. Whatever happened to the mobile missile idea, they wondered. My friends, the answer is still what I revealed in Audio Letter 55 in June 1980. America's real mobile missile is not the MX at all, but a smaller, completely secret missile. It's called the Minuteman TX, and it is being deployed now on America's railroads. Each TX missile is transported in a special car with a barn-like peaked roof. A number of my listeners have seen and photographed Minuteman TX missile cars since I described them in my June 1980 report. About 6 months ago, I released a special bulletin which presents two of these photographs. In Audio Letter 55, I explained that the publicity surrounding the so-called MX program was only a cover for the secret TX mobile missile program. Recently, I reported that the TX missile deployment is scheduled to be completed by next spring, around 6 months from now. Now that the program is nearing completion, the MX mobile missile cover story has just about run its course. That's why the Reagan administration is now dropping its pretenses that the MX will be mobile. Controversy will continue to swirl around the MX program, but the idea of a mobile missile is now changing in official public statements. Now that the Minuteman TX system is becoming an accomplished fact, we are beginning to hear trial balloons to get us used to the idea. For example, Senator John Glenn appeared on the CBS television program Face the Nation last month on October 18. Senator Glenn said that the Department of Defense ought to deploy a smaller mobile missile than the MX. He proposed putting them in trailers on the nation's roads, traveling all around the country. The system he described was almost identical to the secret TX, the traveling Minuteman, which I made public 17 months ago. There was only one important difference in what Senator Glenn described. He carefully avoided talking about railroads, but instead talked about truck trailers. If he had mentioned railroads, he would have let the cat out of the bag, because railroads are how the secret TX missiles are actually deployed. The deep secrecy surrounding the Minuteman TX program springs from the fact that it is not a defensive weapon. America's secret military planners plan to use it in a nuclear first strike against Russia. On top of that, the TX missiles in our midst are placing all of us on the front lines for a nuclear attack. Today, we are all in the trenches. Up to now, the major media have maintained a news blackout on my charges to this effect. But one magazine has now had the courage to publish my charges together with TX missile car photographs. The magazine is called Combat Ready. My charges are published in an article titled, Is the MX a Shoot-First Weapon? It is in the January 1982 issue, which just went on sale nationwide. I first reported that America was secretly shifting to a first-strike nuclear policy against Russia in the summer of 1978. At the time, many people found that idea unbelievable. But now, as war itself draws closer, the first-strike posture of the United States is becoming more and more obvious. Soon after the Reagan MX decision was announced last month, its first-strike implications were spelled out in the New York Times by Herbert Scoville, Jr. Scoville, a former deputy director of the CIA, wrote an article which begins with the words, quote, President Reagan's decision on the MX missile signals that the United States is now firmly and publicly embarked on a first-strike strategic nuclear policy. This is a prescription for a nuclear disaster, a disaster unparalleled in the history of mankind, unquote. Scoville points out that the MX, as advertised, makes sense only as a first-strike weapon. For one thing, the MX is alleged to be an anti-ICBM weapon, but the only way the MX could destroy Russian ICBMs sitting on the ground would be if the Russians had not fired them yet. In other words, we would have to shoot first. Scoville points out that the shoot first idea becomes even more necessary in light of the decision to put them in old Titan silos. The Defense Department itself says that Russia's largest missiles, quote, are capable of destroying any known fixed target with high probability, unquote. In other words, the Titan silos cannot be hardened enough to protect them from Russian missiles. So the only way the MX could be used would be to shoot first. If all Americans were aware of authoritative statements of alarm like this one, perhaps disaster could be averted. But most people these days never hear such warnings. If we are lucky and alert, we may see it once in a newspaper, but it is soon washed away by the never-ending flood of lies from Washington. Most of us remain oblivious to the danger, and so we raise not a word in protest as our leaders sell us down the river to disaster. Even so, the secret first strike preparations of the United States are not entirely without opposition. The plan is known within the walls of the Kremlin, and Russia's leaders are at work on several fronts. For one thing, they are continuing the campaign of attrition against America's war-making capacity, which they started several years ago. One day, a railroad train derails and several chemical tank cars bound for a defense plant explode. Another day, an unexplained explosion wipes a small weapons laboratory off the face of the earth. Next, a rash of military plane crashes take place. The pattern keeps changing constantly so that it cannot be identified, but it is there, and it has its effect. What the Kremlin hopes for most in its campaign of attrition is that America's war plans will somehow be deterred altogether. That is their hope, but it is not what they actually expect. Of all people on earth, Russia's present-day leaders know the Bolshevik mind. So long as the Bolsheviks here continue to determine America's military policy, the Russians are convinced that war is inevitable. And so, with their ongoing campaign of attrition, they are trying to limit the damage that can be done to Russia. From time to time, the Russians carry out something spectacular in their double campaign of deterrence and attrition. As I say these words, an incident has just ended that had deterrence as its main purpose. I'm referring to the celebrated case of the Soviet submarine, which ran aground in super-sensitive, restricted Swedish waters. 3 weeks ago, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger became the first American Defense Secretary ever to visit Sweden. He spent 4 days there. The Bolsheviks here want to entangle Sweden and all the North countries in their war plans. The Russians are equally determined to prevent that, so it was decided that Swedes should be encouraged to think twice before involving themselves militarily with the United States. 2 submarines were dispatched to the Swedish coast. Both were instructed to use their sonar-defeating equipment to penetrate the Swedish coastal defense zone. Next, one was to play cat and mouse with Swedish anti-submarine forces. The other one was to let itself be discovered deliberately, deep inside one of Sweden's most sensitive naval zones. This is how the case of Soviet submarine 137 came about. It has been portrayed as an embarrassment for Russia, but it was really the opposite. The Russian sub-commander maneuvered his boat so deeply into tricky, heavily defended waters as to make it painfully obvious that it was no accident. Then, in a demonstration of the wry Russian sense of humor, he carefully nudged his boat onto some rocks and just waited to be discovered. After a while, the sub was discovered, not by the Swedish Navy, but by a fishing boat. At the purely professional military level, it would be hard to imagine anything more embarrassing for the Swedish Navy or more sobering. Just to make sure, though, the other Russian sub started through its paces as soon as Sub 137 had been found on the rocks. The second sub, deep within Swedish territorial waters, deactivated its sonar-defeating equipment. It then prowled around as noisily as possible until a Swedish anti-submarine warfare task group arrived. The Swedes were all set to start dropping depth charges on the seemingly trapped sub. Then the sonar-defeating equipment was turned on again, and the sub simply vanished. Taken all together, the total experience was a downright scary one for the Swedish Navy. The Russians allowed the Swedes to save face in the public eye. But it was the Swedes, not the Russians, who heaved a sigh of relief when Soviet submarine 137 returned to international waters 2 days ago. The Russians are hoping the Swedes will not involve themselves in America's suicidal first-strike posture. But, my friends, they will. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. As I say these words, an American space shuttle is once again being prepared for launch. We're told that it is the shuttle Columbia, but that shuttle was destroyed by Russia last April. Instead, it is the training shuttle Enterprise, relabeled Columbia, that now sets on the pad at Cape Canaveral. According to my latest information, NASA still plans to carry out an aborted mission of some type. It may be an aborted takeoff, as I first reported last June, or it may be an abbreviated orbital mission. But in any event, the lives of the astronauts are in very grave danger. Whatever NASA does, it will be a desperate gamble. They are trying to keep up public appearances so that their military space shuttle plans will not be halted. But Russian cosmospheres are once again on patrol along the Cape Canaveral launch corridor. This shuttle is carrying no military payload, so perhaps they may not interfere. Perhaps. No matter what happens when the space shuttle takes off, one thing is certain. The government will not tell you and me the truth about it. The space shuttle could be a tool for peace, but our leaders are trying to use it instead to prepare for war, nuclear war. Like the Sadat assassination, the MX missile decision, and America's worsening economy, the space shuttle program is launching us into disaster. What we lack most of all these days is the truth. Our rulers have built their power on lies. So long as we accept those lies, we remain within their power to use and destroy us. They walk in darkness, and they try to keep us in the dark. The only way to break free, the only way, is to seek and cherish the truth. The light of the truth takes away the power of darkness and lies. The truth is the sword of our Lord Jesus Christ, and with it, mankind can yet be free and live in peace. The choice, my friends, is up to you and me. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.